Welcome to the Angry Admins Podcast for December 12th, 2006, episode number 7. Hey everybody, welcome back. This is the Angry Admins Podcast. My name is Joe Bibby.
And I'm Ryan Necessary.
On this show, we talk about technology in the workplace, gadgets at home, and basically where we think information culture is headed. And we've kind of loosely dedicated this podcast to the underappreciated sysadmin, and so we wanted to put this out there based on that. So on the radar this week, first story is from Mr. Ryan.
Yes, so I picked up on this a couple days ago. Apparently, there's a guy by the name of Pat Dory who had a Dell laptop. Well, he started having problems with it, so he started calling Dell tech support, as you know any normal customer would. And after, it looks like, 19 phone calls and tons of emails and 5 months of just back and forth and getting nowhere, he decided he was going to sue Dell. The interesting thing, though, is how he did it. So instead of serving the papers of the lawsuit to the Dell headquarters, he sent the lawsuit notification to a kiosk in a mall, a Dell kiosk. So
nice.
If you can imagine, you know, some court-appointed guy going up and serving some, you know, young person who's working at the kiosk who is basically clueless and like, you know, you've just been served with papers. So of course, what's going to happen to those papers? They're going to get thrown underneath the desk. And
are you saying that mall employees are not top-notch employees?
I'm saying they have the potential to be as good as they can.
Meaning they have no potential.
No, I'm sure there's some mall folks that are awesome, but you know, we can only say that in this case, they did not notify their upper management. So, anyway, the guy shows up to court, and what a surprise, Dell does not show up to contest it. So the guy was suing for $3,000. The judge automatically awarded it to him since the other side, the defendant side, didn't show up. The cool thing was, too, is that if Dell didn't pay the $3,000, then the part of the ruling was they allowed the bailiffs to close the kiosk and seize items from the kiosk in replacement for the cash award. I just thought that was pretty sweet that, you know, he had the paper nice, served to the kiosk. Nice. So
so the next story on the radar, VLC released a new version this week. If you don't know what VLC is, head over to videoland.org. And basically, it's a alternative media player to like Microsoft's Windows Media Player or QuickTime. It can pretty much play anything as long as you have the correct codec. And so it's a pretty sweet little player. It's not exactly beautiful. There are skins for it, but it doesn't seem to work very well. But the nice thing about this new version is it has support for Windows Media Video 9 and Flash Video, which there aren't very many Flash Video players. There's the one, you know, that you can actually get from Adobe/Macromedia, but you know, it's pretty clunky. It's nice to have that built in just your general media player, because more and more Flash Video is all over the place. So. And if you are borrowing Flash Video, which we will cover later in the episode, you can just play it right here in VLC. So, pretty good. A few other things, it has improved H.264 support for the Apple remote if you're on a Mac, full screen video controller, improved playlist, you know, just some basic bug fixes. So, pretty nice.
Up next, a story from UCLA. It looks like they have had a hacker penetrate their awesome layers of security. For those of you that have ever dealt with college computing, you know that sometimes college campus networks can be notoriously lacking in security features. It looks like a hacker penetrated and accessed their database for, I guess, student records and financial aid. They're saying one number in the article quoted by CNN was 800,000 records were exposed. But representatives from the university were saying, oh, it was far less than 5% of the database. So there is no, you know, who knows where the number is, probably somewhere in between that. They're saying that mostly what was targeted was Social Security numbers. They didn't give details on the software of the database or the tool used. Once again, we have, you know, another big case of, you know, someone, you know, not tightening up things enough, and then all these private records, you know, potentially be used for identity theft, you know, or just now out in the wild. USC, I think, last year had a similar case where 270,000 records were taken from one of their databases. But, you know, and I think it was last year also, we had the Veterans Affairs, the laptop that was stolen that had the what was it, 26.5 million veterans records on that. So,
yeah. Not good.
Not good, folks. Yeah, so please secure your records if you're a DBA.
In the toolbox this week, we have several plugins and a couple other nice little tools, but we'll start off with the plugins first. The first plugin I have is, these are all Firefox plugins, but the first one is called the Web Developer plugin. This one is really, it's really nice. So as a web developer, normally you want to check your source code live, you know, see if it validates with CSS validation and HTML validation, check maybe different video sizes, you know, there's just quite a few things that you really want to look at, and this toolbar kind of combines them all into one nice little app. It shows up as a toolbar in Firefox, and let me just go through a couple of lists of things you can do. You can disable your style sheet, or just certain parts of your style sheet. You can easily view style sheets of websites you're browsing at. Say you see a nice website and you want to see how they did that. Instead of having to look through the source code to find the style sheet link and then typing that in manually, you can just one click and you've got the style sheet right there in front of you. You can have one click to view the source code, which you kind of already could do, but this just makes it a little easier. You can resize your window to specific sizes. So if you wanted to check how your website looks in 800 by 600, you can. Or you can give it specific sizes, 1024 by 768, or random sizes if you want. It'll validate your CSS, your feed, your HTML, links, section 508, and even WAI. It'll also do speed reports. Just, I mean, I could go on and on, but we'll have a link for this in the show notes. But I really recommend this if you're a web developer, even just casually. This is a good way to make sure that your website is going to look good, and just kind of simplifies everything for you. So it's pretty nice.
Nice.
Next one we've got is along the same lines. So we've got IE7 we've talked about in the past. IE6 is still the largest browser market share, and it has some problems with true HTML. And so you want to check your page in IE. And, you know, so you can open it in Firefox, you can open it in IE separately, and, you know, yeah, that's pretty good. But if you want to install this plugin called IE Tab. And basically what this does is it allows you to view a web page as a tab in Firefox, but it's using the IE rendering engine. So you're actually seeing an IE page, but it's inside your Firefox browser. So everything's all in tabs. And the other nice thing this can be used for, say you have a website, for example, good example is Outlook Webmail. Outlook Webmail on Firefox does not render very well. It gives kind of a basic page, and if you use IE, it looks quite a bit better. Now, I don't really like having to open another browser just to check my email, so what I do is, if you go into the preferences for IE tab, you can actually enter specific websites that it will automatically open in an IE tab. So when I go to my Works Outlook Webmail, I click on the bookmark, it automatically opens in a new tab in IE without me even having to think about it. And if you're wondering, you know, well, what if someone could like hack into this and start opening IE browser windows for everything? You know when it's an IE tab because it shows the little i.e. icon, where the favicon is in the tab. Yeah. So you definitely know when it's using one or the other.
Cool.
And you can actually enable a little toolbar button, so you can just click and switch back and forth between the two. So if you're checking your website to see if it's rendering correctly in both, you just click back and forth quickly and you're good to go.
Yeah, this is really the win in a corporate environment, because a lot of times corporate web pages or whatever aren't, you know, the greatest, or maybe there's some proprietary tools or documentation that really only renders mm-hmm. right in IE. So if you're a Firefox user at work, this is really good for that too.
So next plugin I have, this is the last plugin. This one I've referenced in the last episode, and earlier in the episode I also referenced it. This is called the Fast Video Download. This thing is pretty much pure sweetness. It's very simple. All it does is if you're on YouTube, Google Video, I'll give you the list later of all of them, but all you have to do is click a little button on your toolbar and it downloads the FOV file. So all those paid videos on Google Video, you can easily download the standard def version of it. Any of your favorite YouTube videos, download them in the FOV format, open them up in VLC, and watch them on your own time.
Nice.
And then if you've got good conversion software, which I think VLC even can do, you can convert it from FLV to, say, .mov or MPEG-2, or throw it on your iPod. So it's simple, but it works well. Supposedly, it's also able to grab things like QuickTime from embedded sources. I haven't had much luck with that, but you know, give it a try. Let us know what success you've had with it. But here's a list of some of the services it supports. Let's see: Daily Motion, iFilm, eVideo Share, Google Video, Budfile, Street Fire, YouTube, vSocial. Basically any flash video service, it's going to be able to grab it.
Nice.
Or if you're on your friend's website and he's got flash video, just click your little button, you get the FLV file, and you're good to go. They finally recently added support for Download Them All or FlashGot, which are download services where you can pause your downloads, resume them, use multiple streams to download them, get them faster. So very nice, and I recommend you try it out. We'll have a link in the show notes to that.
I think I'm installing that tonight.
It's pretty nice. So the final tool we have for you this week is for all you Windows sysadmins out there, especially those of you who do not have a domain controller. You're in a small business, or maybe you just don't have access to the domain controller, but you have lots of Windows machines that you need to keep up to date that maybe aren't on the network, or you've got laptops that are going in and off, on and off the network. This is called the Do-It-Yourself Service Pack, and what this is a little script that this company has put together out of the UK. This company is called Heist Security. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. And basically, it's a little GUI that automatically grabs all of the service packs, updates for Windows versions going back to Windows 2000. So that includes XP 2000 and Windows Server 2003. And it'll pull them all down off the Windows updates servers. And then you can build either an ISO to burn a CD or even a DVD, which would then include all versions. So you could have one DVD with all the updates for Windows 2000, Windows XP, Windows Server 2003, everything. And in multiple languages even, and you throw that in a box, and you've got a little GUI that will let you automatically install these all easily without having to go through Windows Update. You can even have it auto reboot for you and continue the installation. So after you install Service Pack 2 and then you've got 30 more updates to install, you don't have to be sitting there watching it on reboot. Pretty nice little app. Haven't had a lot of experience on this yet, just found that this week, but I recommend trying it out. We're going to put it through some more testing, and we'll probably do a rewind on this, let you know what success we've had with it. But it seems like a really useful app. What do you think?
Yeah, I like this for several reasons. One would be, did you order the fire truck?
I did not order the fire truck.
Okay.
So now that the Christmas parade has finally gone by, thank you very much, fire department. let's get back to the story. So the other cool thing about this little app is that when it's done with everything, it actually opens up a log file in Notepad and lets you know what has successfully installed, if there's been issues. So you don't even have to dig down to find the log to see what actually happened. So it's pretty nice. I don't know. Have you looked over this at all?
I looked at this briefly. I think this is a really good idea. I can think of quite a few instances where this would be useful. Number one, for folks on dial-up who can't download tons of patches for Windows. You know, it's like, you know, your family members or, you know, somebody gets behind and they don't have connectivity. You know, you could always burn up, getting them caught up. The other application would be for, like, I know we have some labs at work which are isolated, you know, off the network.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, to keep those guys up to date, you know, you can bring in an ISO with all these stuff and keep those kind of, you know, fresh and fully patched. So.
Right, and since we have no idea when somebody will just randomly grab one of those and throw it on the network, it's good to keep those up to date.
Right.
So, talking about, you know, bringing updates to your family, especially since we're getting close to holidays, you know, you can go back and listen to our holiday guide, but this would probably be a good addition to that. You know, you can bring a DVD with all your updates for your family and be ready to go and don't have to waste. I remember going to my in-laws one time, they're on dial-up, and we installed XP on their machine. Oh man, it took all night to download Service Pack 2.
Yeah.
And then we had all the updates after that. It was so frustrating. So
yeah.
This would have been perfect for that situation.
For our feature story this week, we're going to talk a little bit about some different Linux distributions and which one may or may not be right for you. To get started, I guess let's talk about Red Hat. Red Hat, also known as the Fedora Core, has been around for quite a few years. They're probably one of the most widespread Linux distros out there. A lot of businesses have this running on their servers and workstations. There's lots of support out there for these guys. You can find it on any store shelf, just about. They do a lot of development in-house, so a lot of the applications and desktop elements are developed, you know, at the Red Hat, you know, headquarters or whatever, and a lot of it is pretty well integrated with itself. Some of the problems with Red Hat, though, are if you want to run it professionally, you're gonna have to buy support, mm-hmm. because it's gonna time out after 12 months, and then you're gonna need patches, and you're gonna need, you know, access to support forms probably, and all this kind of stuff. So, you know, it quits being free, you know, and you know, if you buy like enterprise, then it's gonna be pretty costly to get started with it. But you know, they offer certifications in it, and it is one of the major distros that you're going to run into in businesses.
So would you say Red Hat probably is the most popular corporate Linux?
I would say that.
Yeah.
You know, and it's getting kind of hard to tell, you know, Red Hat from Fedora. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, you know, what's the difference? And, you know, it seems that Fedora is sort of the, you know, the open source, and they let everyone develop for it, and then basically the Red Hat folks, the Red Hat team, pulls from the Fedora project and rolls the best of the best into the enterprise Red Hat, which then is supported, you know, and you know, to do all that. So
maybe the big difference would be, like, because it's so widely corporate used, Red Hat, especially Red Hat Enterprise, is maybe the most stable of what they have. Like, it's solid, it's been thoroughly tested. It's like Fedora is kind of used as their test bed, maybe?
Yeah, I would say that.
Is that accurate?
All of the stuff for Fedora is more the cutting edge, I would say. So it's like the newest stuff, the latest drivers. But Fedora probably is not nearly as stable, I would say, as the Red Hat, you know, corporate releases. So.
Sure.
One drawback on Red Hat is their patch management isn't that great.
Okay.
I mean, UpToDate is one of their tools for, like, keeping all your packages at the latest rev, but there's been so many times in the past years that, you know, you want to try to update something, and it's like the patch needs something. So it's like, oh, I'm missing this library. So you go and install that, and then that needs two other things. And so you try to track those down, and those things need something else. And I don't know, they're slowly getting better, but the patch management on Red Hat, in my view, is just not nearly as friendly as some of the other distributions that we're going to talk about in a few minutes.
So we basically have Red Hat to thank for RPM madness.
Right, yeah, the RPMs. And in their defense, when RPMs first, you know, came out, they were like, wow, this is great. You know, you can add them, you can delete them, and you can just, you know, use a line command and manage it all this way. And, you know, now there is more, you can do it in the GUIs and stuff, but, right. You know, RPMs have been so far surpassed by some other tools and other distros that, you know, it really is just kind of an old technology.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a big Red Hat user, but when I have used it, it does seem like every time I try to install something from an RPM, it's before I can install, it's like, you need this file with this version. Yeah, it's kind of a pain.
It just goes on and on. Okay. But, I mean, overall, Red Hat, very good. I've had many versions going all the way back to version 4 or 5, I don't know. It was one of the first ones that I was able to do dual boot on a laptop.
Nice.
So, I mean, there's a lot of good things with Red Hat, and there's a reason why they're probably number one out there. Mm-hmm. It's because they are stable. They're pretty good. Moving on, let's talk about Debian. These guys have been around for quite a while, since 93. Debian is 100% free. They got a good, pretty good community out there. It's tested well. And these guys' patch management is top-notch. They have the apt-get, so...
Oh, right.
Yeah, so, you know, basically, if you're missing something, you kick off a command or run the GUI, and it just seems to work. You know, it reminds me of Apple, you know, just like the stuff goes out there, it does its thing, it doesn't spam you with a bunch of errors and stuff, and it just seems to work so much better.
Right.
It kind of second-guesses what you're trying to do, and it satisfies the dependencies ahead of time. So it's a really good one. Some of the downsides, people say that the release cycle is kind of slow. If you do get a hold of a stable version, it's probably not very current. So you're kind of making a choice between, do I want the latest and greatest, or do I want one that's not going to have problems? So
by current, you mean maybe like it doesn't have the latest Linux kernel?
Right,
or like maybe the latest versions of each piece of software.
Right, or even maybe like the Uber graphics card drivers that just came out.
Okay.
You know, so if you run in something on an older computer that you need to be super stable, if you get an older Debian release, you're probably going to be fine with that. I guess from there, we can talk about SUSE. We've talked in recent episodes about SUSE Linux being acquired by Novell and then them partnering with Windows. There's a lot of, you know, political maneuvering going on with that right now. That being said, SUSE itself is a pretty well fleshed out Linux package. You install it and it looks good. There's a ton of tools. Everything is well integrated. They have YAST, which is the graphical system administration tool. So if you're new to Linux and you want something that, you know, you just install it and you want everything to be there and have a nice graphical controller for all of the Linux, you know, elements, you know, the networking and the users and all that, YAST is a good solution for that. A lot of people, that was the selling point was, you know, I like Linux, but I can't configure anything. So, you know, YAST was their, you know, foot in the door to get that to the folks that were new to Linux. These guys have, through YAST, you can do package management. I'm not that familiar with it. I mean, I've ran SUSE a couple times, but I'm not sure how easy the patch management is on that.
Well, I can cover that a little bit. This was actually the first version of Linux I ever got running on my own.
Wow.
So I have a lot of love for SUSE. I had tried Slackware, one of the guys I knew was like, oh, you got to use Slackware. And I tried to install it, and he wouldn't help me get it working. So I bailed out and got myself a copy of SUSE. And the package management is actually, it's really nice. Using YAST, and actually the newest one has YAST 2, which is kind of a graphical version of this. You know, it's very similar to apt-get, where, except it's not command line. It's you just open up YAST, and you can search for the package you want. You can even add listings to it. So if you want, like, you know, some of the less stable versions, you can add those to your list. And it'll download, find everything you need, and install it for you. And I've really rarely had problems. I haven't used the latest versions. I kind of stopped using it a couple years back. But this was kind of my first. This is what I kind of... cut my teeth with SUSE. So I would definitely say it's worth checking out at least.
Yeah.
They do a lot of good. They seem to be on the bleeding edge of graphics. You know, they're always there supporting the hardware 3D, and they were one of the first to really get good graphics support, it seems like.
Yeah. SUSE feels to me, maybe even to a little further extent than Red Hat, it feels like there's a lot of money behind it.
Yeah.
You know, it's... You know, I mean, the Germans were the ones that started SUSE, and it almost feels kind of like a German car. Like, there's a lot of little parts in it, and, you know, it runs really well, but there's, like, a lot to it under the hood.
It's kind of like, it's the feel I get with Red Hat, too, where, you know, they kind of just go for the install everything, and you take out what you don't want later.
Exactly.
And, you know, I don't know what everything you're going to cover, but Red Hat and SUSE seem like the ones that do that the most.
Right. From there, let's talk about... Mandriva, formerly known as Mandrake. These guys showed up on the scene in about 98. They were one of the first ones to do a really nice graphical installer to help folks, you know, because, I mean, if you can't get it installed, you're not going to go anywhere with Linux.
Mm-hmm.
Mandrake has always been a little bit known for being sort of buggy, though.
Okay.
I think it's a fun distro for folks that don't mind that. You know, if you're a Linux enthusiast and you want something that is easy to install, and you're not demanding like business-like, you know, reliability out of it, it's maybe going to be on your list for ones to try out. If you want the latest and greatest of the Mandriva, there's a Mandriva club that you need to join. So, if you're in the club, you get the latest and greatest. But if you're not,
is that free?
You know, I don't know. I suspect that it's not. Yes. So.
You know what that means? They're totally fired.
Failure. So if you're not a club member, then, you know, you're going to have, you know, not the latest and greatest, but that may not be important to you. After Mandriva, you know, no Linux Roundup would be complete without a mention of Ubuntu. Our favorite. So yeah, these guys, they showed up a couple years ago, and they really... I really credit their success to them just giving away as many copies as possible.
Mm-hmm.
You go to their website and you're like, I want 20 copies, and bam, they'll ship them to you for free.
Yep.
The bad thing is there's like no business model for this company right now.
Yeah, I don't know how they can pay for all that. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, but it is a very good distro, easy to install. It installs not everything, but it feels like you're getting the stuff that you probably want.
Yeah.
I would easily recommend this as a great starter Linux for people that are interested in it. There's a lot of different flavors for it. Like there's Edubuntu and mm-hmm. Kubuntu, you know, for the ones that are, you know, so there's some with different flavors depending on what you want to do with it. And all in all, they're not that different. They do have some package management through apt-get. And I think actually Ubuntu is kind of a descendant of Debian.
Yeah, I think they are.
So it sort of feels like that under the hood.
Mm-hmm.
But they have a really good community, and you know, they're all about promoting the spirit of community and togetherness and harmony, and that's kind of their little you know, spin that they put on Linux.
Yeah. Yeah, I you know, this has been my favorite. This is basically, I abandoned SUSE to go to Ubuntu, and you know, they get a lot of flack because they're kind of, because they don't install everything, and they kind of have a more, it almost feels like they don't want you to use the command line because there's so many graphical interfaces for everything.
Right.
But, you know, I think that's kind of misled. I think it's just the feel that they give, because it's really, if you want to get in there, you know, you can use apt-get just like on Debian. Mm-hmm. And, I just really like the only install what I need and then I can add it later method.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yes, in SUSE and Red Hat, you can go through and uncheck all 5 million boxes
and
get exactly what you need. But I'm really a big fan of Ubuntu, and the fact that they will ship me a CD, and since I think a couple versions back, it's even a live CD that you install from a running copy.
Right.
So... You know, it just feels, it's really a good place to get started, and if you want to get down and get dirty and add into it, you can.
Right. Going from our favorite to my least favorite.
Yes, and we know how I feel about this as right. well.
Yeah, don't get Joe too close to this one. We'll talk about Gentoo Linux. Gentoo came on the scene a few years back. I think 2002 is what I'm looking at in the notes here. Gentoo is for the folks that are the hardest of the hardcore. If you're a super geek, if you're a programmer,
if you're a moron,
if you like pain, then Gentoo is the Linux distro for you. Seriously, it's a Linux for folks that have a very specific need.
Mm-hmm.
It is very up to date, very cutting edge, but installing it takes forever. You really need to understand everything that Linux does to get it running well, or to get it running at all. And it is based around the idea of only compiling into the kernel the things that you want. So, right. You know, if you're some sort of hardware programmer and you're putting something together and you want it to be the most slimmed down, you know, race car, no frills, you know, bare bones Linux to get the job done, then Gentoo is a good choice for you, because it's going to let you strip it down to the bare essentials, and then you're going to wait 24 hours for it to compile and install itself. But, you know, it does have its uses, but I try to stay away from it.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, you know, exactly what Ryan's saying is, if you, especially if you're a programmer and you know what you want to code it to, it's perfect for that.
So it's like, install this.
Yeah. I mean, it's going back to the days of when Linux was almost unusable to the average person.
Right.
And while I appreciate that, you know, I really would like to see, along with I think most Linux users, Linux take over everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not going to happen if everything has to be built from source code.
So. Yeah. But, I mean, with all the Linux distros out there getting easier and easier and more graphical, you know, there is going to be an audience out there
right. For
this part of it, you know. So, I mean, this is where Linux came from, and,
true.
You know, there'll always be a demand, I guess, for the super hardcore, gnarly, source code-only distros.
So, right.
For those of you that love it, we salute you from a very big distance away.
The only other one I'd like to mention is one that I think probably, if you've never used Linux, this is the best way to get started. And there are other ones that do this, but this is kind of the original, and that's Nopix.
Mm-hmm.
It was the first one. I think it was the first. I don't know that for sure, but it was one of the first I heard that you could actually take the CD, throw it in your PC, boot to it, and you have a full version of Linux running without having to do any sort of install.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them are doing this now. We mentioned Ubuntu, and it does it too. But this one, you know, it was kind of the first, so I have to kind of mention it, even though it may not be the best one to use anymore. But I've met several people who, you know, they're into computers a little bit, and I ask if they've used Linux, and they say, well, I've used Nopix. And I'm like, yeah, that's Linux, you know?
Yeah.
It's a perfect way to get started, so that's all.
Yeah, Nopix is awesome. You know, I guess the first time I heard about it, it was just like a hardware recovery.
Right.
Like, you know, throw in the live CD, and you can rescue your machine, or, mm-hmm. you know, do some diagnostics or whatever. But, you know, it is a full-blown distro that, you know, a lot of people really like, so.
Yeah, and if you're into security scanning, in quotes, there's Nopix STD, which is their scanning version.
Right, for diagnosing potential security flaws.
That's right.
Yeah, they're all good. So, you know, if you are interested in Linux, feel free to, we'll have links in the show notes. Most of these have a free download or a live CD for you to check them out. I would recommend throw in a second hard drive on your PC.
Mm, definitely.
Dual boot it. And then, you know, just use it, play with it, get to know it. Especially, you know, if you're mainly on the Windows side of things, it's really good for your resume to, you know, to have some Linux on there, because eventually you're going to start running into it. And it's so much cheaper than a Windows file server.
Yeah. So, which one would you recommend to get started with?
Home, Ubuntu.
Okay.
Work, I would say Red Hat.
Okay.
Just for compatibility.
Yeah, I think that's probably smart.
What about you?
Yeah, I would agree with that. You know, Ubuntu's trying to break into the server market, but they're not even close yet. So, I would agree with that. The only other thing I might mention, I know we're kind of going long here, but CentOS.
Right.
Is the kind of free Red Hat Enterprise version. You know, I'm not going to claim that it's totally secure like Red Hat, but it's a good way to kind of get used to the Red Hat flair of everything.
So, without the Red Hat price.
That's right. Well, that's going to about do it this week. We want to thank you for listening. And again, if you liked any of these stories, feel free to check out our website, www.angryadmins.com. And we'll have some show notes up there and links to different parts from the stories. And also, if you guys, you know, hated something, loved it, have some ideas, please post some comments. We always love feedback because this show is really all about listeners, and we want to make sure that you guys enjoy what we are talking about. So, my name is Joe Bibby.
And I'm Ryan Necessary.
And remember to stay angry. Hey, Ryan, you got any coffee?
No. I got Coke, though.
Coke? Man, Coke is like liquid acid.
I know, that's why it's good.
But I need my caffeine fix, man.
Coke has plenty of caffeine, dude.
But it will also eat the dirt off a penny.
That's why it's good, because if you drink enough Coke, it like cleanses your system. Like you can cook an egg in Coke.
That's so nasty.
So you could just like drink Coke and then eat a raw egg and it would cook it in your stomach and save you the time of cooking your food. What other drink could satisfy that? Plus, it's been around since like the 40s or the 50s or whatever.
Yeah, but coffee's been around way before that, and it's actually like natural.
Yeah, but see, Coke is the improvement of natural. It's just like, natural is just like staring at your wife, and the improvement is staring at the TV.
Oh, that's awful.